Hi, and welcome to the Interviews with the Masters podcast brought to you by theoutdoorinsider.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear. Today, I have with us on the phone a guy that's kind of been sparking a lot of talk in the industry. He's part of a team of guys that's behind most of the big hunting films and a lot of the stuff you see come out from Sitka and stuff like that. I have Aaron Hitchens from Rockhouse Motion on the line with us today. How you doing?
I'm great. Happy to be here. Sad our hunting season in Alberta here is over and excited to talk about hunting.
There you go. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and give our listeners a good rundown of Rockhouse and what you guys are all about.
Yeah, so Rockhouse Motion is a team of six at this point. It's myself, Matt White, Dustin Lutt, Colin McMillan, William Poulin, who is our graphics and animator guy, and Logan Ross. So we are basically a boutique creative consultancy. Mm-hmm. We create content, we solve creative problems, and we make films. So that ranges everywhere from directing and producing the TV commercials that you'll see from Cabela's to making films like the one we released this past year called Beyond the Roar, photographing print ads, and everything in between. So we write stuff, we shoot stuff, we tell stories, and we work with a lot of really great brands in the outdoor industry and beyond.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And how long have you guys been doing that for?
I think the company now is 5 years old. Matt started the company. He was formerly actually a firefighter. And then Dustin partnered with Matt, and I partnered with both of them. And so I think it was about 5 years ago that Matt got things off the ground and founded Rockhouse.
That's pretty badass to go from fledgling company 5 years ago to probably the go-to, if not, the best in the industry, in my opinion. You guys do amazing work. I've been in the industry a long time, and I've always aspired to come out with films that have the production quality and the eye that you guys have is just incredible. Like, I've always wanted to produce stuff like that, and not having the know-how or the resources or the money to come up with anything like that, my film's far short of the good stuff that you guys put out there. So
yeah, I mean, we're certainly lucky to have, we have the best equipment available, and we've worked really hard to learn how to use it, which is a very underrated part of the game. And
yeah.
We're being able to partner with great brands that facilitate us putting the time and energy and effort into learning the trade and hopefully mastering it or moving towards that anyways.
Yeah. So you're a big hunter. How'd you get into hunting?
Oh, it was my dad, basically. He and a group of five of his close friends sort of founded this hunt camp. They were all mostly new hunters at the time, and they bought 100 acres and built a cabin, and Annapurna Hunt Camp was born. And basically that hunt camp was sort of raised me as a sportsman hunting white-tailed deer in Ontario, where I grew up. So I was originally introduced to deer hunting with my dad and his buddies, and then fell in love with waterfowl hunting and hunting turkeys. And then that was sort of my passion through high school. And then, as I've sort of discovered the big game world and dove into bow hunting and really understanding that you can call in big game animals and have that same thrill that you do with a duck, except with a, gigantic mountain beast. It's really, yeah. Things have gone from bad to worse as far as my hunting infatuation is concerned.
Yeah, and you get out of hand pretty quick.
Correct.
That's for sure. That's for sure. for people looking outside looking in, it's a very hard thing for them to grasp how passionate and how much time, money, and resources that we invest into doing what we love to do. But those of us who know, know. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your film that came out this year made a big splash, no pun intended.
That's really fitting for this one.
I know you were emotionally driven. This film had more than just the hunt on the line. There was more to it. I'll let you get into that. Why don't you give me a little rundown of the actual film and the background of it and so on and so forth, and I'll got some questions for you after that.
Yeah, so the film is basically, gives an opportunity for a viewer to travel along on a journey with myself and one of my best friends in the world, Will O'Brien, on a Yukon moose hunt. We flew into a remote backcountry lake and paddled a very relatively remote but pretty much neglected river in the Yukon, just because it has quite a bit of hazardous and prohibitive whitewater. And we had the genius idea of accessing this unhunted area by running those rapids in an open hard shell canoe. And what we learned is that there's a reason it doesn't get hunted very often, and there's a reason that the whitewater is considered prohibitive. And we certainly struggled on our way downriver, but we were successful in harvesting a pair of awesome moose. And the inspiration for the trip was unfortunately linked to the passing of a close friend of ours, Andrew Burrows. He'd sort of inspired. We'd had a really interesting exchange in the years leading up to his passing, where he'd inspired me as an older member of my community, and he's been a friend of mine since basically I was born. He's sort of like the filmmaker from my community where I grew up, and he'd inspired me to dive further into filmmaking and storytelling. And at the same time, I'd inspired him to get into hunting, and so we had plans of a documentary or an epic journey or a TV show, and we've been working on a ton of stuff, and we've never, you know, we'd never really seen it through. And so this was Will and I's way of paying tribute to Andrew, seeing that through, and hopefully sharing the inspiration that he gave us with other people and passing along his legacy.
That's pretty cool. Now, Will was not much of a big game hunter, right? He wasn't a big game hunter at all or something like that, right?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't at all. So I introduced Will to hunting in high school. Prior to the trip, he'd shot like 2 geese, 4 ducks, and I guess 5 turkeys. He loves turkey hunting, and that had been it. The moose in the film was his first big game animal, and he actually went to another river in the Yukon this year and shot another one. So, credit to him for that and getting that done.
Absolutely, that's badass. So, I mean, you're emotionally driven by the passing of your friend, and you're going into a hunt with a partner who never big game hunted before, and you never really whitewater rafted, right? Is that what I understood? You weren't a whitewater rafter, but Will was.
Yeah. So Will is like. He's a master at it. I mean, he does it for work as a paddle guide, but he's also just like he's an enthusiast. And and I've done some kayaking in the past, and I'm a capable paddler, but definitely not in whitewater, and definitely not in a canoe, and definitely not in rapids of that scale. So Will's expertise was basically I needed to rely on that over the course of the trip.
So you guys were both relying on each other to pick up the other ones. I guess pitfalls or so to speak. I guess you know.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, neither of us would have been able.
Yeah, you couldn't have done it without.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. We couldn't have, I'd have drowned, and he might have shot something, but we really did have to rely on each other, and it was cool because it opened up a new area of potential and potential adventure that we wouldn't have been able to access otherwise.
That's pretty cool. I mean, my hat's off to that's a big undertaking for even for seasoned people. So to go down there and not be a seasoned rafter or a seasoned hunter and so on and so forth, that's a big time undertaking for sure.
It
What are
was
some of the things?
certainly an interest.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, it was certainly an interesting feeling flying in and looking at just like the absolute absence of humanity in this area, and not just thinking, oh, we have to get out of here, and not just thinking, wow, how are we ever going to find a moose, but thinking about how are we going to film it. My business partner Matt, who shot the majority of the film, and then we had another friend of ours on the trip, Terry Milne, who's an experienced whitewater guy as well. But how would we, not break all of our stuff? How would we, find room to camp? And it's just a giant undertaking that we were almost intentionally unprepared for. Like it was, obviously we had what we needed to survive, and we weren't taking risks. But there was sort of this sense of discovery that was really fascinating.
So what are some of the things you did do to prepare for that hunt? I mean,
Oh,
other
I
than
mean,
the obvious, I guess.
yeah, just understanding, understanding as much as we could have, right, from a personally understanding as much as I could about the moose rut and how moose behave, and how they are in the Yukon, and everybody has this sort of a vision of that area being just like riddled with moose, but it actually has a really low density. They're just really big. So, understanding that. And then, looking at maps from a whitewater perspective, knowing, sort of picking, okay, this is the progress we'll be able to make in the X amount of time. How are we going to cover, when are we going to have to challenge rapids? And there are actually a few rapids that weren't on the map that certainly threw us for a loop. And just Will understanding what he had to take on, what rescue equipment we needed, in case things went sour, which they did, and understanding, safety equipment for that, and then from a filmmaking perspective, how do we keep all the batteries charged? How do we back up all the media, all the stuff from the memory cards? How do we keep our gear from drowning, essentially, knowing we'd be in and around water the entire time? And so we actually packed a generator, which was quite the ordeal,
Oh, I bet.
And we had like Pelican cases that we cut the foam out of so that there was quick access to a fully built camera if something happened, so Mac could get at the camera quickly. And lots of little things like that, and that really came together to put us in a position to succeed.
Sounds like a logistical nightmare. I
It
freak out.
was fun.
I have my shows. I have one camera guy, and we're usually running one camera, maybe a GoPro with it. It's very rudimentary, and I can only imagine how that takes a bunch of work and takes a bunch of doing to get shows done. I can imagine just having a whole team of guys trying to make this happen. It must have been just nuts. How many days did it take you to do?
It was 12 days, I think, start to finish.
Okay. So yeah, definitely. Did you do any pre-scouting or anything like that, or just went in there
No, I
blind?
mean, this place is like truly in the middle of nowhere. So,
Okay.
we asked around, and there are always locals that know things. And,
Right.
Will is a really respected member of that community. So, people were excited. They knew the area. The area is known to hold moose. And yeah, but scouting it would have been a real mission. So we just kind of, looked out the window as we flew in and gleaned whatever information we could from that as far as how the habitat was going to be, and sort of went for it.
That's pretty badass. So, you live in Canada, in Alberta, right? And what hunting trips did you do this year?
I actually was really lucky this year. I managed to shoot a nice elk here in Alberta. I filmed a project on Kodiak Island in Alaska and shot a really unique double drop time blacktail. It was like a cactus buck,
Oh,
um,
badass.
which I wasn't even expecting to be hunting, but due to the generosity of some friends and sort of an interesting debate, I managed to get to shoot that one, which is a story in and of itself. And then I shot an old buck in Kansas that was pretty run down from the rut. Mm-hmm. And then I shot a small whitetail here in Alberta right at the end of the season and had a mountain lion encounter wrapped into that. So every little part of it has its own story. It was quite the eventful season.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sounds like it. So I want to go for blacktail bad. I mean, I've gone for blacktail in, like, Washington and California and Oregon and stuff, but I'd like to go for sitka blacktail for sure. They're super unique in the way they act, kind of reminds me of our coos deer down here, from what I understand from everybody that I talk to and the stuff that I've watched. So I got a big thing for coos deer. So I feel like it's definitely a creature I would love to chase around. I'm planning on probably doing that. Maybe I'm not sure if I'm gonna do it 2017, but 2018 for sure. I just need to see what's coming up this year. My past season's been a little funky. I didn't hunt quite as much as I normally would because I was preparing for my sheep hunt and thought I was going to be spending a whole month hunting that. And so prepared my wife for that. I gave up a few hunts and stuff like that, and it ends up, I end up shooting a sheep on the third day. So,
yeah, that's well, congratulations for that. That's no small accomplishment. And I imagine hard earned, both in the scouting leading up to it and in the dozens of years that you probably had to wait to draw the tag.
Yeah, 17. 17 years.
Wow.
You and I were just talking about that, how different it is. You guys can hunt sheep in Canada over the counter, right? One sheep,
yep.
Is it one sheep a year?
If you shoot one, you have to take a year off.
That's what I thought. Okay, so every time you get one, you got to, okay. I thought it was one in every five, so it's one every other year, basically, if you're able to kill. And that goes the same for a lot of, so you guys can shoot moose. I think the only thing that's a draw that I can think of right now is doll sheep and mountain goat.
Yeah, it depends on the province and or territory.
Okay.
So, mountain goat in BC is easier to get than it is in Alberta, and some things switch around there. But yeah, doll sheep can be a draw. Yeah, I mean, we can get into the nitty gritty of it or just acknowledge it. It's a pretty happy hunting ground up here, and while, that makes things very challenging, it's nice to be able to spend the 17 years doing what you can to get it done, because that's a lot of pressure. I can't imagine going into a hunt with knowing how long it's taken and knowing how unique of an opportunity it is.
Well, the other thing about it is it's once in a lifetime, so I can never draw that tag again. And that's the part that's hitting me the worst. I'm like, what, why did I shoot on day three? I should have, just, unless I found an absolute giant, I shot a respectable ram. It's not about that. And I know I would be happy with him had I shot him on the last day. It's just knowing that I can never draw that tag again is kind of eating at me a little bit, that I didn't prolong the adventure. I really
absolutely.
Nothing to
I think
do, nothing to do with the actual trophy, but the adventure.
It's an interesting thing. The whole I actually disagree with the premise of, if you shoot him on the last day, shoot him on the first day.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just don't agree with that. I just think that's unfair. I mean, you'd shoot a lot of crazy stuff on the last day. The whitetail I shot at the end of this season, I would definitely never have shot on the first day of the season, but it was the last day of the season and I had a great experience with it and I had a hard fought season. I wanted to take something home and fill my tag. And I think that on guided hunts, it's the same thing. You fly the whole way up to Alaska or wherever, and you spend all this time and money and years looking forward to this, or a sheep tag you spent 17 years to draw. It's not about the animal and what it, the size of the animal. It's about the adventure. And you might regret not having shot something, but you'll regret that having lived out the entire journey Whereas, you know, I've seen quite a bit of buyer's remorse over my experience filming hunts when people sort of apply that logic and pull the trigger sooner than they would have otherwise.
Yeah, I'm with you. I guess it all depends on what you hunt for, what's your philosophy. See, I'm an experienced hunter. Like, I'm not a trophy hunter. I'm not a meat hunter. I'm actually both, you know, and neither at the same time. I've kind of developed this philosophy that has ultimately made me a much happier hunter. That I'm just hunting for the experience. And if I see something that makes me happy, if it's the first day, it's the last day, you know, day in between, whatever, I'm going to shoot it. And if I feel like the experience was worth it, I'm going to shoot it. This hunt was very different for me. I found it really hard for me to follow my normal because there were so many things connected with it. And meaning, you know, that it's once in a lifetime, I can never draw it again. That not many people do it with a bow and a certain degree of difficulty and whatnot. And I had all these things playing in my head. Also cost, you know, every day I stayed down there, it was costing me $250, you know, or more, just the expenses there, not to mention what I'm missing from not working. You know, just stuff like that. Just all these things go through your head. Am I really going to spend a month down here away from the wife and kids and all this stuff? And I just wasn't my normal hunt for the experience that I usually
and it,
do.
And it's tough when you're hunting something like that. And I struggled with that a bit this year, actually, with our elk season. Is normally when you go on these, you know, these crazy dream hunts, you're gone and you have a window of time. It's like, I have 10 days, I'm in this place, and this is when my flight home is, and I'm not going to miss the flight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever it's in state or in province, it's tough drawing the line. Like, instead of just checking out of the world for 10 days and going and getting after it, you're sort of stuck with this, all right, you know, there's still stuff I can do. You go home, you reset, you know, you could finish on the third day and go home on the third day. It's not like you finish on the third day, you're there for another week, and you know, it's just a totally different approach, and it's unique.
Mm-hmm.
Because not often do you have a hunt of that magnitude that's that close to home.
Yep. And I really had this envision, and I've been trying to connect with Aaron for a long time to get him on here, but we just kept missing each other or whatever. But It's interesting that I have you on right now after this hunt. I had such visions of grandeur for the film of this hunt. And I had so many guys that were going to come out and help and so on and so forth. And I was very lucky to have the people that I had. But I'm not exaggerating when I said I had probably 50 guys contact me and say, yo, we want to help you on that hunt. Or I want to help you film that hunt, or I want to help be a glasser or whatever. And I just had all these visions for this, for the film, and it just, I'm sure it'll still make a decent film, but it's not going to have what I envisioned. And that too was eating at me. We just don't have, I mean, the shot footage I got, we had two camera angles on it, and the guy that was down with me, Levi, who's been with me for the past 12 years with my show, he had it over the shoulder, and then we had one from up top. And it just, for some reason, it's just not, it doesn't have that, oh my God, feel to it. It feels like most of my TV shows, which are, like I said, rudimentary, doesn't have that same, like, epic, I don't even know how to verbalize it, but.
Well, I think a big part of what you're looking at is, you know, if you're comparing it to Beyond the Roar, is that you really knew what you were doing, and we really didn't. You know, like, I'm a capable hunter, but I'm not, you know, I'm by no means an expert, I'm by no means a super experienced bow hunter. It's my first time I've ever called a bull moose into 10 yards. It is an extremely emotional journey. I hadn't, you know, we hadn't been into the area. We didn't have any animals earmarked. So what you ended up getting with that was just, you know, some super, super, super raw emotion. And,
right.
You know, a super raw, you know, I'm at full draw for 2 minutes on that moose, which you can't really tell in the film because it's slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm already shaking like a leaf just from trying to hold my bow in a dry suit after paddling a rapid, like, you know, basically
yeah.
paddling for my life, and then come around a corner and all of a sudden there's a moose and I'm at full draw and it's cold. And, you know, there's just all these factors that made it extremely intense that none of those would I have chosen to include if I'd been like, oh, create, you know, create your perfect kill shot or perfect opportunity. You know, I wouldn't have had to take a shot at a turning moose and, you know, be able to, you know, thankfully I made the shot, but shoot through like a, you know, a golf or like a tennis ball size window in a bunch of brush. Like, it was just crazy. And I think that's kind of the thing about it is, one, it's the fact the animal's coming in to
mm-hmm.
a call and it's so tight. And like the uncertainty that we felt really shines through in the kill because
right.
it's very real, you know? And I think that that's one of the challenges that really experienced hunters like yourself and you know, with spot and stalk hunting is, while it was a, you know, it was a sheep and it was unique and it was new territory and a new approach is, you know, you're spotting and stalking and killing an animal. It's just something you've done quite a bit. And so having that shine through is tough. But I mean, what I would say
mm-hmm.
in the film is, you know, if I were to offer any wisdom is just be honest. I mean, be honest about all the parts of it. Like, you don't need to make it, doesn't have to be super badass. It doesn't have to be the sheep hunt that, you know, you hiked 400,000 mountains and, you know, you
right.
don't have to create this grandeur. I think that what people resonate with or what resonates with people and what I think really resonated with people with Beyond the Roar was just the authenticity and the honesty. You know, one, it was very emotionally charged, but two, you know, we weren't, we really tried to understate things. We didn't go in and say, yeah, it took us 8 days of calling dawn to dusk to call in a moose, you know?
Right.
We just showed the hunt and let people interpret from our emotions
mm-hmm.
what had happened. And I think that one of the big things that people do in hunting films is they're almost looking for epic, so they overstate stuff. And I think that if you're honest about the journey versus, you know, how it was in reality versus how you expected and then why that's
mm-hmm.
still valuable to you and why this experience is still valuable, then I think that's, you know, there'll be something that people can glean from that and take from that into their own once in a lifetime hunt that they wouldn't be able to access otherwise. I think that there's a, you know, there's an opportunity in a weird way for you to sort of create something unique with that body of work and the stuff that you, you know, the stuff that you captured on that hunt and the story that you're telling me and listeners, I guess, right now about how you feel in hindsight. You know, I think if you share that through the film, I think it'll be really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think it's, it makes sense now that hearing you verbalize it. That so like when I go to film my other hunts, I don't go into it thinking I'm going to make a film. I think I go into it thinking I'm going to make one of my TV shows. And doing that, I always have a more of a educational approach to them, and it's a little bit more kind of systematic. And I think because I went into this thinking I want to make a film, I didn't. I don't know if it came off as authentic. Maybe it was a little forced, you know. But, I mean, it's only 3 days, so I didn't have a whole lot of, you know, interaction or, you know, a lot of on-screen comments and so on and so forth. Again, I was planning on filming for, you know, however long it took. It's a month-long season. So I wasn't trying to cram everything in that first 3 days. But yeah, now hearing you say it now makes me realize why possibly it didn't have that feel that because I wanted it to have that feel, and it kind of came off maybe it tried too hard.
Well, and the other thing is that, you know, you're used to TV and you're used to on-screen comments, but you know, if you watch Beyond the Roar, we have very few moments where we're speaking.
Right.
It's, you know, it's crafted
mm-hmm.
and that's, you know, it's intentional. We throw in moments of real life dialogue as well. But you know, the challenge is when you get in the editing bay and you create that film and you understand the direction that it goes and the feeling you want to create, even if you said the best, most insightful, perfect thing at the time in the field, it's very unlikely that it fits into that arc. So it ends up getting to be a bit distracting. When if you just channel, you know, if you look back and you know how you felt and you're authentic to how you felt, but you fit that verbally into a more sort of specific journey with a voiceover, I think it can be pretty powerful.
Yeah. So I had Ibex Hunt last year, and we turned that into a film. And I don't think I didn't go into that one the way I went into this one. And that one, I feel like you see all the emotions, because I shot one in the face that we couldn't recover, and I was devastated. Most people don't even get a shot opportunity, and I felt like I had my shot opportunity, and it went, you know, I shot one in the face, and I wasn't going to get another one. I was devastated about the fact that I wounded this, you know, awesome animal and all this other stuff, and it came off really, really good, even though from a technical standpoint, I didn't go into it with the same, you know, we weren't using cameras with slow-mo, we weren't using... I was filming it on my X-A10, you know, and my Nikon D7100. So I wasn't like using my crazy camera equipment. Where this hunt, I took my bigger cameras with me, and you know, I had those capabilities and all that stuff. And it's just, I guess, one of those things, you know. We'll see. We'll see how it plays out. I might be overreacting, but I hope it makes a good film and people could take something from it. So,
yeah,
I did
I
want
mean,
to
you shot a you shot a desert bighorn. That's a people are gonna want to watch that. You have that on your side.
Yeah, that's
you know?
True. That's true.
And I think you did a really great job promoting it, you know, in real time on social. So it'll be. It'll be interesting to see how the story matches up. Just understand what you want people to feel and understand how you feel and then, you know, make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I got some questions for you. So we get questions thrown at us all the time on social media, and I figured you'd be the best guy to answer these questions. I always get a lot of people asking me that are trying to get into, either get into the industry or at least filming their own hunts for what they you know, for their own personal use or just to, you know, throw up on social media or their YouTube channel or whatever. One of the questions I get all the time is what camera should I buy? Even though we all know that in capable hands, your cell phone camera is probably better than most people know how to use. And you can make some pretty amazing footage with just that technology. But if you had to suggest a camera for somebody, let's start with that, and then I'll get into the other questions I got for you.
Yeah, it's always a tough question because budget, you know, budget's always a huge factor. I mean, I would recommend a Red Epic Weapon would be an awesome option. It's $80,000, so
yep.
I would dial it back. you know, I understand not everybody has that luxury. So I think basically just an SLR, I think, is going to be the way that I would always recommend that people start because it gives you the opportunity to have photo and video capability. You can get autofocus, but I think it's a good habit to develop the skill to sort of manually focus, understand different lenses, you know, and just work from there. So I think a single lens reflex, you'll just have to fit that to your budget. You know, Canon makes some great ones. Sony make some really great ones with some great video that are really lightweight if you're a mountain hunter. A7R II is one that we use actually quite a bit for a number of projects. And, you know, Nikon does as well. There's a ton of great options out there. But I would definitely say start with an SLR. You'll have the opportunity to shoot photo and video in one camera, which is less weight. And, I mean, lots of them are shooting 4K, and they'll give you a 60 or 120 frame per second option, and you can roll with that.
Sure. Well, it's not even that, though, that could get expensive. I mean, so you're talking about, you just mentioned the Sony. That's a $3,000 camera body. You know, most of these guys, I think, are looking for, they want to spend like $1,500 or less.
And then I would say
probably something you don't even look at, so you probably don't even know. But
yeah, but what I would do is instead of going low end modern, and now this is probably wrong, but this is how I feel anyways. I would rather get like a Canon 5D Mark II, which you're going to be able to get now for much cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Like what was formerly a top of the line camera,
right? Just by using,
as opposed to like a lower end one now. But I don't know if that's right. That's just what I would guess. I'm not super familiar with that space.
Yeah, I figured that might be a little bit out of your realm. Well, I'm going to interject there, I guess, then, because I found a really good camera that takes amazing 4K film and has slow motion in it and variable frame rate, slow motion from 60 frames to all the way up to 900 and whatever frames per second, which is pretty damn good for a prosumer camera. The Sony RX 10 Mark III, and it's got a Carl Zeiss lens on it, and it goes from 24 to 600 millimeters. So you got quite a big at f/2.4, no less. So it's kind of a good all-around camera for $1,600. It's kind of hard to beat. And it has the capabilities to add mics and, you know, put it on. It's got great stabilization. I mean, even handheld out at 600 millimeters, you wouldn't even know that somebody's hand-holding it. So that's a really great camera for that. But I agree with Aaron. If you want to get serious about this, you need to have the right tools. And an SLR camera is going to give you the capability to do, in the right hands and with the right training, you can film stuff that's worthy for TV, you know, high-end commercials and stuff can be filmed on a Canon, you know. Well, I never played with the Mark II, but Mark III I know for sure. So do a little. It's
yeah,
more
I mean
about,
those we've shot.
Go ahead.
We've shot some pretty big work that people may have seen just on SLRs. You know,
yeah.
It's important to remember too that you have to have it with you for it to matter.
Exactly.
People get too big or too heavy or stuff that the batteries die or whatever, and it's like sometimes the best camera is your iPhone because you actually have it, so you want to understand something that you're actually going to bring along and use and have the means to shoot with as well.
I filmed two complete shows in the last 3 years on my iPhone, and they were very well received. This past season, I released a Coos Deer Hunt with Craig Knowles from the Outdoor Insiders. That it was his first Coos Deer. I filmed the whole thing on my iPhone. We had an issue with my camera. It wouldn't work. My Montana hunt that's coming up this next week, part of it was filmed with the iPhone because it was so cold that my camera wasn't turning on. And couple of years ago, 2013, my elk hunt here in Arizona was primarily filmed on my iPhone again because I was having battery troubles with my Canon. So, yeah, it's just all about I think learning how to use the equipment more than anything is more. And I'm terrible. I'm a terrible operator. And I definitely need to take my own advice and go get some real instruction. I know enough to be dangerous. That kind of leads me into the next question I had for you. If a guy wants to kind of get into filming and being more proficient with the equipment, is there Is there a school or something that you suggest? I know that, you know, Campbell's and those guys, they kind of run these, you know, 2-3 day schools or whatever, but is there something that you would suggest other than getting out there?
Honestly, I would suggest buying a camera, whatever it may be, just YouTube and Googling tutorials on how to operate that camera and get the most from it. Mm-hmm. And then look at work you like, look at stuff that motivates you and moves you, and do your best to replicate it, and then understand what you do and you don't like when you watch something, and then, you know, allow that to inform your work. And I think that innately it's just such a personal thing that it's tough to learn. I mean, there are very few tips that I would say apply to everybody. You definitely want to understand the basics of like aperture and ISO and, you know, your shutter speeds and your frame rates and everything along those lines. But mm-hmm. once you understand those basics, which you can find on like a million YouTube tutorials, from there, you know, just do work, make work, watch it, try and find people who will critique it honestly, critique it yourself. You know, what parts do you sort of cringe when it comes up on the screen and you're showing somebody? What part are you anxious about? What part do you love? And then do more of what you love, less of what you don't love, and eventually, you know, you'll have good work. And whether or not it's work that anybody else likes, if you can understand what you like, you know, then you're creating at least a meaningful memoir for, you know, yourself and your own experiences.
Right. Now, I know this is like the most important thing about filmmaking, but I've never been able to verbalize it to somebody. And honestly, I don't have the secret sauce in my head. It's telling the story. How does someone perfect, or how do you go into something? Okay, so you said you kind of went into this hunt very unscripted and very obviously kind of hard to script a hunt because the animals are going to do what they do. But do you guys have like a guideline, or do you have like a, you know, a certain amount of shots or whatever that you require the operators to take every day, or, you know, do you have a formula, so to speak, so that the story is told?
No, I would say the first thing you have to understand, especially when it applies to hunting, is, you know, you really have to do justice to the location. And the location, you know, what are the things that you notice better when you're there? Is it a little wildflower on the side of the mountain? Is it a sunrise? Is it, you know, the rocks or the plant life, or whatever? You shoot the things that stand out to you and that make the location unique, and then shoot a little bit about how the animals interact with that. You know, because at the end of the day, it's a setting or a landscape to us, and it's a habitat for the animals. So, you know, whether it's tracks or rubs or scrapes or whatever, you know, identify how the animals have adapted and how they live within that space, and then basically go from there to the elements. You know, how does the weather affect the hunt? That was a big part of our experience in the Yukon, was the weather.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know, Matt did an amazing job highlighting that. And from there, you know, understand what if there's like a simple guideline, it's like, think about if you went home and you were going to tell your friend, you know, what happened, what are the things you're going to tell them? Well, those things you're going to tell them, you shoot that stuff.
Okay.
You know, I think the big part is that people don't think about what the story is. They think about storytelling and they don't think about the story. You know, you understand the story, and obviously there's parts of it you can't predict, but
mm-hmm.
on the first day of the Yukon, you know, the story of that day was like, holy smokes, we're alone. So the way you shoot that is big wide shots of small characters and, you know, a giant foreboding area, and kind of the weather really led to that, and so we went from there. So with every step of the way and every step of the journey, you know, you think of the energy that you want to sort of tell, and then, you know, a static shot is a peaceful feeling. If you want to have a crazy intense feeling, you shoot moving stuff, or you move the camera and you sort of energize that scene. So that's really what it comes down to, is understanding the, you know, the sort of the truths about the location and the energy about your experience in a space, and let that come through. I think, you know, there are obviously always some shots that you need to get, but I think some of those are leaned on too hard. You know, we don't have a shot of me drawing my bow in the Yukon because, you know, you knew I drew my bow because I shot the moose and the arrow wasn't going to leave leave the boat if I didn't
Perfect.
draw it. There's some stuff that's implied. And I think
Mm-hmm.
that people get really caught up on like, oh, you took the safety off. You better film taking the safety off. You know, if you get it organically, great. But we really work hard not to recreate anything. You know, obviously there's times when you have to do it, and there are times when I think that it's more, you know, a little bit less harmful than others. But you know, at the end of the day, you
Right.
just try and be honest and organic and understand what the story is, and then look about how and think about how you would bring someone here with, you know, with words, and then take them there with images.
Right. Speaking of recreations, I have a question for you. What's your thought when you see, well, I'll tell you what I do. I mean, it's obvious that I do it because there's no way you can have this shot without it. We always film the blood trail or whatever leading up to the animal. So that part's organic, the excitement of seeing it for the first part. But then I always do that other shot where the cameraman's already at the deer or whatever, filming me walking up to it. Where,
so there's two.
I've
There's
had,
basically two ways. Sorry, what's your question about that?
No, I've had guys, look down at that, and then other guys appreciate the whole, second angle thing and understand that, I am doing it for art's sake and not for, trying to fool somebody, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't mind it. I would never apologize for it. Like you're not going, inventing some event, like if you're, it's a real thing that happens and you're just showing it. So basically there's two ways to look at that. One, I always would try and capture the innate reaction of seeing the animal for the first time as your blood trailing. And even if that's imperfect, like it was in BTR, in Beyond the Roar, when, Will sort of taps my shoulder and does this little flex fist pump thing. we definitely would not have done that if we knew the camera was rolling and I kept covering my mouth like a weirdo, but that's organic. But if not, what I do a lot of the times is if I want to set up that reverse angle shot is, if you know the animal's dead,
mm-hmm.
or you've seen it go down from a distance, is I'll go up ahead, I'll get in position, and then I'll be able to film the person, even though they know the animal's there, I'll be able to film their authentic reaction because they actually won't have seen it.
Right.
So I think that's actually a fun way of doing it. It's like, okay, you see a bit of fur on the ground, or you see the shape of the animal, the person, the hunter turns around or looks the other way, cameraman goes up there. So then you're able to see like, what do you actually, what is the first look at the animal? What is that reaction?
Right.
And that's kind of the way I try and handle it. But it doesn't bother me when people do it one way or the other. I just think that, you have to understand the energy. Like, do you want it to be super authentic? The more authentic you want to make it, the less likely you are to do that shot. But at the same time, it's a cool shot. It shows the animal. And, it's just whether or not you can get that reaction in a way that's meaningful.
Right.
If they've already seen and interacted with the animal.
Absolutely. Cool. My last question is, what would you suggest that amateur filmmakers focus their efforts on? Is it building their brand, building a style of, of how they film, or, I don't know, people always, I guess, the reason why that question comes about is, I guess everybody's trying to get into the famous, but, where should a film guy, an amateur filmmaker, be focusing his efforts on?
I mean, this sounds like a cop-out answer, but it's really not. I mean, they should focus on doing great work,
mm-hmm.
and honestly, there's a big opportunity for people that can do really great work. But sort of the dirty secret is, once you get to a certain level, we did a film called Game of Inches a few years
right.
ago, didn't do one the next year, did Beyond the Roar, didn't do one similar this year, because for us and all of our equipment and all of our professional obligations, it becomes almost difficult to put the time and energy in to make a really great hunt film,
mm-hmm.
Just because it doesn't make sense from a business standpoint.
Right.
But if you're doing it as a hobbyist, and you can take more time and have less obligation and put a lot more focus into something. So there's a big opportunity in the market for work like that. And that's how you see people sort of rise up and enter our space successfully, is mm-hmm. when they have their own story to tell and they're able to focus on it and tell it really well. So basically what I would recommend is, you know, tell a compelling story, do great work, and, you know, share stuff that you can attach some meaning to. And when it comes to photography, I mean, obviously great content is great content. And this is something that I'm still learning. You know, how do you manage your own social?
Right.
How do you how often do you post? What do you post? You know, I don't think there's a right answer to that. Some people post all the time. Some people post very rarely, just incredibly beautiful work. You know, some people blend it. I don't really know. I think, depending on the scope and scale of your goals, one thing from a social perspective that I've found is if you're focused, like if you fly fish for brown trout mm-hmm. and all you post is fly fishing for brown trout, people are more likely to follow you and keep following you because they know that you're a source of great brown trout fly fishing imagery. If you hunt for mule deer in the high country with a bow and that's your whole thing, people follow you to see high country archery mule deer. That doesn't necessarily lend itself to a lot of people because a lot of people do crossover work. It's always funny. I'll go fly fishing. I'll post some great fly fishing photos. I'll gain some followers. Then I'll go deer hunting. I'll lose a couple followers. I'll gain a couple followers. Then I'll go ice fishing. And then I'll lose a bunch of followers because nobody cares about ice fishing, you know. and then it's just, you know, you can't – I don't really worry about it. Some people do. But if you really want to sort of make a mark, I would focus on a niche from a social perspective. And then – yeah, as a filmmaker, just do great work. Create a long or like a meaningful long form story. That's rare. And to have the opportunity to do it. So your competition is going to be less. And the opportunity for you to do that, for you to do something that's really lasting is there. So, I mean, it's not an exercise in futility. There's legitimate opportunity in the market.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the rub is that there's guys that don't produce good content and yet seemingly have, fame. And then there's guys that produce amazing content that don't have the same fame. And I always had that same philosophy as you, build it and they will come, so to speak, or, you know, produce content is king, produce good content, and eventually, you'll have a following. But I don't know if today in that day, in this day and age, it's necessarily true.
I think that it is from our journey because, you know, if the people listening to this podcast are, you know, anyone that average outdoorsman, I think you've probably seen our work, whether it's in a magazine or on TV, you know, even if you don't watch the Hunting Channel or Cabela's spots, you know, they're on ESPN and stuff. Like, you've seen stuff that we've done, but there's a good chance you have no idea who we are. Over time, you know, people start to connect the dots. And even if they don't, I would always rather, and I think our team would always rather, do the great work, take satisfaction in doing the great work. And, you know, if we have a few thousand people that really appreciate our work and are inspired by it, that's good enough for us. We're not looking for this sort of transcendent fame. We're just looking to do the best work and let the work inspire people. And if people are inspired by us, then they're more than welcome to join us on the journey because it's been a hell of a journey. But we're certainly, you know, and that following does grow. I mean, people, you know, every year you go to the trade shows and there's a few more people who say, oh, hey, I saw this or that or you know, whatever. And it's really interesting to see, but I definitely, you know, build it and they'll come. That's the way to earn. At least that's the way we've done it, and that's the way that I think you earn the most respect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let the work speak for itself as much as you can.
Agreed. Well, that's all I got for you. You got anything cool coming up? Any films in the works or any cool hunts coming up or anything that?
Yeah, we're working on a big saltwater fly fishing trip in French Polynesia to fish a bunch of waters that have never been sport fished. So that's pretty major.
Wow.
It's taking up a lot of time and energy. And then, yeah, just looking for recommendations on anywhere in the northwestern U.S. that we can go and do some fun public land turkey hunting next spring, because one of the really fun parts of our job is we meet a lot of people that don't hunt that have an interest in it, and I think turkey hunting is probably the best way to introduce people to the sport.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Anyone that has recommendations on where to go and set up a little
South
rock
Dakota.
house turkey camp, South Dakota?
South Dakota.
We'll see you there.
There's a lot of turkey, and it's kind of one of those sleeper states. Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is I've never killed one there, but I've deer hunted there a whole bunch, and there is turkey everywhere. And I was going to shoot one in the fall, but I know some guys out there that live out there that turkey hunt all the time, and it's just, to me, it seems like, I mean, like I said, my interactions with them were always in the fall. I've been there probably 5 times now, and they respond to calling in the fall. I was just playing around with them through a turkey call in my mouth, and they came in on the string, you know? So I can only imagine when when the rut's going or whatever, and come spring, they must be on fire. One of my good buddies, Dave Ciani, he owns High Prairie Lodge and Outfitters. He does turkey hunts, and has 100% success rate for like the last 15 years with his clients. So
it's pretty solid.
Yeah,
that's encouraging. That's pretty, for sure.
And most of them do it with a bow, so that's pretty cool. I think not out of ground blinds, you know, talking set up call, and it's kind of a Western experience, you know. South Dakota is where, in my opinion, where the Midwest meets the West. So you kind of get the best of both worlds. You get all those really good whitetail hunting experiences, but you still get, you know, elk and bear and mule deer and antelope. Oh, shit, there's a lot of antelope in South Dakota, too. That's where I shot my first one. Still my biggest, actually. Yeah, lots of good opportunity there. It's a game-rich environment, for sure. So,
sounds like a hell of a spot. Well, we'll have to give it a look in the spring, maybe.
You got to come down here in Arizona with the rest of the Canadians. In half the year we're half Canadian in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Oh, you're in Scott. Yeah, that's definitely snowbird environment for sure.
But yeah, you guys got to come down and film a hunt here and do a mule deer hunt in the rut. That's some really good hunting and a lot of good opportunity. Even javelina and stuff like that, stuff that you don't get to hunt in other places. Coos deer, great hunting experience. You know, now basically our season opens on the 9th of December and goes all the way through to January 31st. So, and that's when they start running. It gets a little bit better after Christmas, and it's great the whole month of January. Great experience. Good place to get some nice film because the mornings here, this time of year, the way the sun comes up and the angles and the way this illuminates the mountains and stuff, I think it's just begging for a film to be made. Somebody who's got a good eye and the capabilities to do so. I've always wanted to make a really good one here. Just again, don't have the know-how to do it, but eventually when I grow up, I'll learn how to use a camera the right way. And I'll do something, but yeah. So anyway,
awesome. Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing whatever comes out of that ram hunt and diving into following along on some more of your journeys. Did a really great job on social, keeping people involved and engaged in that hunt. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Once in a lifetime.
Thank you very much. And congratulations on all the success that you've had. Like I said, that's a great, great story to go from not being in the business 5 years ago to being, up at the top of the game, which is amazing. It's a Cinderella story in my opinion, and I love those. Got me to make a little short film on the rise of Rockhouse.
Rockhouse, man, just keep your freezers full, but still stay hungry. That's kind of what it comes down to.
Oh, man. Well, thanks for coming on and sharing some knowledge with us and some of your experiences. I'd like to have you on again after you guys get a couple more hunts done for next year or something, and see how your spring went, how your turkey hunt went. That'd be fun.
Perfect.
All right. Take it easy.
Yep. Thanks a lot, too. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.